Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Tammy Carver. Welcome to the John Carver Show. My husband has helped thousands of people around the world lead happier and more successful lives. Whether you're just beginning to lay your foundation or you've already built your life but need to shore up some weak spots, this show will help you.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Welcome to the John Carver Show. My name is John Carver, and today I am going to be having a conversation with Bob. Now, Bob is not his real name. Bob and I work out at Gold's Gym, and one day we were having a little chat, and he said to me that he died three times. And I thought, what? Three times? How's that possible? So he told me a little bit of the story, and then we met the other day, and I heard some more of the story. So today, I'm going to have another conversation with him for him to share with you more of the details of that story. I find it fascinating. He's come a long, long, long way. Great man. And I think you're going to get a lot out of it. Now, you're going to hear me asking questions in the background from time to time, but the majority of this show is hearing Bob's story.
So I'm here with Bob again.
Here with Bob. And we had a conversation a couple days ago about his life. And his life really blew my mind, because where he was and where he is quite a journey. So Bob is here again. Bob is not his real name, but I promise to protect his anonymity, his identity. And that's okay, because his story will blow your mind. So let's start at the beginning, Bob, and share again what we talked about the other day.
All right, at the beginning. I grew up in a abusive household. My father was an alcoholic and very violent and physical. I have a brother and two sisters who are older, and I seem to have gotten the brunt of his alcoholism. When my brother was young, he wasn't as bad, and so on and so forth. And I was the golden child, so to speak, of the four, and the one who had the most potential. Horrible word. Never use it in relation to anything, ever. The potential. So, and so I could never do anything right in his opinion. No matter if I did do it right, it was not right. As I shared the last time that, I pitched in Little League, that we won the championship the 1 year, and the final game we won, and we won like 3-1. And I was beaten because I gave up one run. It wasn't good enough that we won. I gave up a run, so that I failed. So that's how it kind of went. I couldn't ever do what was good enough, no matter what it was. I can imagine if I would have won 3-0, if I would have allowed a hit or two, I probably would have gotten beaten because I allowed a hit or two. Those were the kind of the parameters I grew up with. And the the idea of being the golden child. I was very smart, so they had these high. I was going to be the first one to go to college. My dad wanted me to be a fighter pilot in the Air Force, and you know, all these great things. And they gave me all these tests when I was young, when I was in fifth grade, I believe it was. And it came out that I was pretty smart. You know, I had a sophomore in college reading and comprehension ability, and I was very good at mathematics, and that I was so far ahead of my classmates in learning all this stuff that, you know, the teacher just ignored me because I could do it on my own. And it would, you know, being told, go over there, you know, let me deal with your classmates, you know, and that's how it was at the house. Go away. You know, don't do this, then go away. You know, and if that wasn't done appropriately, then don't go away because we're going to have a conversation that would turn violent on his part, not mine. And so my parents in the school system decided that in order for me to not feel abnormal, they would leave me where I was. Huh. That was a bad decision on their part. I needed to be around people like me. And my classmates weren't. So the idea of being different started early. Far as I knew, there was nobody else in my classmates being beaten on a regular basis, you know, for anything. It was a whim of my father. Yeah. So that was my secret shame. Yeah. I was coming from a home where there was physical violence and abuse. So I never had friends come over. You know, I didn't have play dates, as they call them now. I always went to somebody else's house, usually the neighbor's, because that was the safest place. You know, and so, which resulted in me coming home very late because dinner was served at 5:15. And if you weren't there, you didn't get nothing to eat. But if I was there, I was getting beaten, so I would not be there. So I went hungry a lot because we weren't allowed to eat unless you were there at the dinner time. That was the rule. You know, so there was all these kind of things growing up. The whole idea of being different was constantly being reinforced around me. You know, I was, you know, it just was too different for me. Yeah. I was way smarter than anybody in my neighborhood. I was also the smallest person in the neighborhood. Yeah, so it was like I was really good and athletic, but I was the smallest, so nobody picked me. Yeah. Even though I was probably the best. Yeah. And so that's kind of the backstory, you know, of how I was, you know, growing up, how it was for me to grow up in this household that was totally dysfunctional. You know, and I became very dysfunctional, and the world around me. You know, it's just, and somewhere in there, because I was so different, I felt different. I carried my secret shame with me, and I was introduced to alcohol when I was 15.
Let me back up a bit.
Okay.
Because last time we talked, you said that one day you had enough and you ran away.
Yes.
Let's go back there, because that was prior to the alcohol.
Yes.
Okay.
I was midwinter up in Michigan, and I come home from basketball. I was a shooting guard in basketball, and in our version of Little League basketball. And so I come home late, 3 days late.
That's pretty late.
Well,
can't blame you.
Yeah, I got sidetracked.
Right.
So, and the beating commenced as soon as I got in the door, which was my MO. You know, that's how I became to operate. And so, and it was over because the trash hadn't been emptied. Taken out to the burn barrel, because back then we burned trash, and so we needed to go to the burn barrel and lit on fire.
Right.
And hadn't been done, because I hadn't been there in 3 days. You know? I went out to burn the trash in the middle of the night. You know, it was 9, 10 o'clock at night. And I was in my boots, blue jeans, t-shirt, and socks. And I went out, burned the trash, and then took off. And I ran out of my boots. You know? So by the time I got gone, all I had on was my socks, my blue jeans, and a t-shirt. And it was middle of the winter with snow. You know, being a small kid, to me it was up to my waist, but probably could have only been like a foot deep or so. Back then we used to have snow in winter. And I ran down to my neighbor's about a mile away. And she took me in, and I got her to promise not to call my folks and tell them where I was. So I was not going back home, but she did, because she had, you know. But the only way I was going back home was the beatings had to stop, because I was going to leave again if they didn't. So the beatings stopped. I might have been really smart, but that was not the highly intelligent thing to do, to run away in the middle of the winter with no preparation. You know, so, but also, I learned not to trust. You know, to me, I couldn't have articulated it at that time, but I knew not to trust after that. You know, nobody was going to be trustworthy. And from that point on, it pretty much has been the way I went through life. Not trusting anybody, whatever you say, no matter what you did, because I knew at some point you were going to burn me. Yeah, so I wasn't going to trust you. And
now, you mentioned when we talked the other day, is there was an incident about a cow, and I know what that is, but I want you to share it again. Now, was that prior to running away, or
yes.
Was that, so it was prior to, so like, I'm going to go back to the cow story and then fast forward. We're not in chronological order here, obviously, but go back to the cow story and then fast forward to when the alcohol started in your mid-teens.
So the cow story. It was a couple of years before I ran away. And And I was putting a milker on a cow and it kicked me in the head. And I couldn't tell my dad or anybody that the cow kicked me in the head because he operated on the principle it was my fault. And I should be punished for that. So I didn't tell anybody about it, but it kicked me right here on the left side of my face. So my whole side of my face was pushed in. But one of the things that happened was I gradually started a personality change. And I didn't really recognize it until later, like in my 20s. But as I had mentioned last time, you know, I was really good with mathematics. And by the time I got to high school, and I was in Algebra 2, 11th grade, and being given the final exam and turning it back in blank because I had no idea what it was, how to do any of it. I had no clue. I couldn't do it. It was beyond my ability to do that final exam. So I turned it back in, walked out of class. Never took another mathematics class again. And I didn't really recognize what that was about at the time. Because it's also about the same time when I started drinking. And I started drinking, and I couldn't drink very much. I was a very poor drinker in the beginning. A couple bottles of beer, and I was passed out on the floor. You know, I had to train myself how to drink a lot. And all my friends used to say, cheap date, because they buy me a six-pack, I'd drink two, and they'd get four. Mm-hmm. Because I was laying on the floor of the car or passed out in the back seat or something because I just couldn't handle alcohol. Mm-hmm. But between the cow kick and the changes in my personality, it's questionable for me to say this, but I started hearing voices. You know, the voices appeared. You know, never outside of my head anything, but inside my head there was the multitude, I called them. And they wouldn't leave me alone. Yeah, and it's you know, if I look at it at this point today, from today back then, you know, it was the shame. It was I was not good enough voice. The shame voice, not good enough voice. The you'll never amount to anything voice. You're just a worthless piece of shit voice. You know, you might as well go commit suicide and get in a, you know, voice. You know, those kind of voices, you know, that came from growing up the way I did. So, and I didn't know, you know, this was early 60s, you know. There wasn't a lot of programs available in rural Michigan for young men hearing voices, you know, other than taken to the state institution, which is what they did with people, you know. And I never attempted suicide or anything. I was always, because I could hear the voice, that I'm such a failure, I would fail at that and be crippled for the rest of my life. In some form of matter, you know, I'd be in a comatose, or I would break my back and be paralyzed because I'm such a fuck up. I couldn't do it, you know, because I can't do anything right, you know. So I never attempted it because there was no point in attempting it because I would have failed. Mm-hmm. It would not have been an unsuccessful suicide with consequences. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that drinking did, it kind of started minimizing the voices, you know, because I could drink two beers, be passed out in a blackout, done. So I kind of continued this behavior until I was about 19, 20. Then, somewhere around there. Then I started smoking pot, which only lasted 6 months because it made me very, very paranoid. I had too many voices, and with the pot, it just really amped them up.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, oh, this is too much. You know, I got to stop. I can't do this. You know, so but then started doing psychedelics, which became really nice until I went off the edge and ended up in a mental institution because I got pulled over by the cops and swaddled, you know, like 10 capsules of psychedelics. And it was shaky for a few days, to say the least. And so, you know, so this is all going on. And then my 21st birthday, somebody brought some heroin. And I had been, we'd been shooting up psychedelics because it's faster, you know. And I had a love affair with needles even before I started doing heroin. So somebody had a little packet, gave me some heroin, and Nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
I was there because the voices stopped completely, and all I had to do was just sit in the chair and nod out, just not think. You know, and the voices were gone. I was happy.
Mm-hmm.
Where do I get more? Yeah. And so for 5 years, that's what I did, was heroin. I was still drinking and still, you know, a couple beers and be done. But the heroin, by that time, there were two drugs I was doing. Anything that was a barbiturate, in heroin, because I knew those things would leave me in a state where I didn't have to deal with anything. Yeah. The voices were done. I was put in a corner and left alone, and that was it. But as everybody knows, the side effect of heroin is eventually you're unemployable. I had reached that point. I was unemployed, unemployable. I was functionally illiterate. I had gone from being the top of my class to functionally illiterate. I could barely read. I could hardly write. And the idea of what do I do next?
Before you get there, you told me that you actually OD'd and died twice from heroin.
Yes.
Okay, go into that for a moment or two.
All right, so the overdoses, the first, both of them were exactly the same way. The heroin, you know, some new heroin came into town. Some friends did it. We took them to the hospital because they were overdosing. And we looked at, this other guy looked at each other and went, this must be some good shit, but we'll be careful. We weren't very careful. We ended up ODing also. My girlfriend at the time found me laying on the floor, you know, which then she proceeded to get me to the ER, and, you know, they didn't have the drug they have now for drug overdoses. They just, like, waited to see if you were going to live or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they put an IV in you and hope for the best. And I came back, and then probably a year later, year and a half later, some more dope came into town that was high potent. That didn't get cut enough. You know, same scenario. He ended up taking some friends to the ER and going, I'll be different, you know, I won't do as much. And my girlfriend found me again laying on the floor, same girlfriend, laying on the floor, overdose, and got me to the hospital. When I recovered and was in the ER room in recovery is when she told me that if she ever found me again laying on the floor, she was just going to let me die right there. And she didn't say it that nicely either.
Sure. Pretty blunt.
She was very, very blunt.
Colorful, I'm sure.
And very colorful.
Yep.
So that was the second one. So this went on for probably another year. And I realized that I was in a lot of trouble. I owed the drug dealers because I was supposed to be selling it, but I was using it, and I had no job. It was just a mess. So I decided that I needed to get off the heroin. But what was I going to go or do was, I had no money and no insurance and no prospects of any. So I decided to move to a different town, rented a small apartment. Filled it full of alcohol and locked myself away in this apartment until I no longer had a craving for heroin, which took a while, but I drank a lot to help through the transition. And so when I got off the heroin is when I really started drinking a lot. And by the end of my drinking career, for another year after that probably, by the end I was drinking a case of Carling's Black Label and a fifth of whiskey every other day. And I didn't go outdoors other than to walk down to the liquor store and get more alcohol and walk back home and sat in my house with the shades drawn and trying to read, which I could read a book in took weeks because I kept reading the same chapter over and over and not know it. But so this is when finally I decided to go to the bar. Because I hadn't been there, and stuff. So I went to the bar and I ran into my old girlfriend, who was the one who was hoping I would die. And that sent off a chain of events where the reason she was no longer was my girlfriend was because my friend was hitting on her. And so I left the bar, went back home, and this guy was sitting in my front room. I drove 15 miles to my parents' house, got one of their guns, came back to my house. He was still there, so I stuck it to his head and pulled the trigger. And the gun went click. And it's one of the very few times ever that the guns from my parents' house were not loaded. We always kept the guns loaded. We lived out in the country, but we did. But the thing that happened the next day, then him and I got in a really big fight. I had black eyes, I had chipped tooth, I had knots on my head. He didn't look much better. But the thing that happened was I had justified my drinking and the alcohol, the drugs, my whole existence on I was hurting nobody but myself. And at that moment when I stuck that gun to my friend's head and pulled the trigger, I had become a threat to those around me. And that made something happen in my head. That I was now a threat to society. I couldn't continue the way I was, just being a threat to myself. So I through a series of events, I ended up in actually the mental institution again. And a doctor came in who I never met before in my life, looked at me, looked at my chart, and I was going through DTs at this time. They had me strapped down to the bed and shit. And they actually, I found out later, were taking bets whether I was going to survive 48 hours or not, or if I was just going to die right there. And this lady won, because I didn't die. She bet I wasn't going to. And, but this doctor came in after 3 days of this and said, there ain't nothing wrong with him, he just drinks too much. And they put me on the alcohol ward. Took me out of the metal ward and put me on the alcohol ward. And from there, it was, I was there for 28 days. Went to a halfway house, men's house, and learned how to live without drinking and doing drugs. And, what it would take, and learn a skill, and how to be productive in society as a useful member of this group that I was now becoming part of. So through a number of steps and stuff, I bulk rehab, got involved, and I was able to learn a basic skill, and it got me some jobs down the road doing stuff. And then I ended up at General Motors, where I spent 17 years before I quit working in skilled trades, and this skill I had learned through bulk rehab. I went through the apprenticeship program and everything. One of the things that happened in the halfway house was the lady who ran it, the therapy groups, required of us to do one thing that we would never consider doing, ever. And for me, was touching people. I didn't have a high degree of success of being touched or touching people. and so I went down to local community college after getting their catalog and went, there's a massage class that involves touching people. I probably will take this class, because it's going to force me to touch people. And the therapist thought it was a grand idea, that I take this class on. Because the only way I knew how to touch people was punch them out. I was a bouncer, in the bars, and that's what you do. Mm-hmm. You punch people out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you get to do it just because you feel like it. Yeah. You don't even have to do anything. You just can punch them. So I found out that I was actually very good at doing massage. And so as I continued in sobriety, working at General Motors, I developed better skills in doing massage, and I started doing massage part-time in a clinic up in Michigan at the time, and my house, and studying more and more. I went to an ashram, became in resident there for 30 days to learn a meditative form of massage, and did a whole bunch of stuff with yoga and stuff like that, just learning how to help people and their journey through life and what it meant to be touched safely. So this continued on, but because I still had an urge to punch people, I got involved in martial arts and opened up my made it to third degree black belt, opened up my own club with a friend of mine and his partners. We opened up a club. So because I had all this nervous anger energy, I was working at General Motors 7 days a week, doing massage 3 days a week, teaching martial arts 4 days a week. Yeah. And I didn't sleep. A good night's sleep for me at this period point in time was 3 hours. Somewhere I could stick them.
Mm-hmm.
But I kept developing my touch, how to touch people and to help. And AA, doing, 12-step calls, how to help people, being in meetings and how to help people. And I got involved with a group of men who their tradition was tough love. We just called bullshit when we heard it. We didn't say, oh, it's nice, don't drink, come back. We would say things like, yada yada, you fucking mind?
Mm-hmm.
What's the matter with you?
Mm-hmm.
Are you that stupid?
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't find in AA today.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's soft and gentle, and it's okay. Yeah, that never would have worked with me.
Mm-hmm.
I needed somebody like my dad to keep me sober. So that's what I sought out, was somebody like my dad to keep me sober. If you had approached me with kindness and softness, and I'd have chewed you up, spit you out, and got drunk. So as this kept progressing and developing my skills of body work, I come across a technique, a modality that I figured that would do enough for me that I could leave General Motors. And so after 17 years at General Motors, I quit. And I pursued this career that I've chosen, and I don't really want to say it, because if I do, then everybody's going to know who I am. So,
I understand.
Okay. So, so I left GM and started my practice in this career that I've chosen, and what I've done with what that allowed me to do was to address another one of my fears, was the fear of others. I was in my little community. If I went outside of my, to a different part of the state, I never felt safe until I got back into the county where I grew up, because I knew all the cops and everything. So once I got back in the county, I was good. Yeah. So I was afraid to travel. But what this did over time, in learning this and being sober, was I quit GM, sold my house, and left Michigan. And since then, I've lived in a variety of different states. I've found out that I really like the mountains. And in each of these places, I always practice the trade. The one I deviated a few times from my chosen career. I ran a cancer clinic for a friend of mine for a while out in California. I was a bodyguard for a wealthy heiress and her children for a year and a half, and I still wanted my hand in that kind of stuff. And I drove semi for a while. I wanted to do different things, and not just be one thing. And I've done that, and I've done different things. I actually have traveled almost around the world, and it's always in wherever I've gone, I've studied more on how to help. I went to Australia for a month and sat with the Aborigines in the outback doing Dreamtime stuff. And how do you do that and help people? And down in Peru with Ayahuasca Girls, and going, how do you help people? doing vision quests to find things that help people. I've spent a lot of my life hurting people until I got clean and sober. That was part of my stuff, was to hurt people because I was hurt and I had no way of expressing it other than to hurt somebody else, make them suffer as much as I've suffered. And I was really good at it. I knew how to do that. I was taught by the master, my dad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, if I look from here back to then, he did nothing more to me than what was done to him. Mm-hmm. And probably what was done to his father. You know, because then you're back into the 1800s. And they did not treat children gently back then. There was a reason they had child labor laws and stuff that came up. Children were for abuse and use. And so I look at that and believe that I've forgiven my father, but I also understand he did a lousy, rotten job. And so did my mother. She was a participant in this, by not getting me or the rest of the other kids out of this situation. So part of me forgives my father. And it's the rational part, the one that understands he did nothing more to me than what was done to him. He did not have the tools to do it any different than what he had. Emotionally, I'm glad the son of a bitch is dead. That's emotionally. You know, I haven't gotten there yet, emotionally, where I can say, oh, I can't. I can't do it.
Of course.
I can intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
I know that part. You know, and so in helping people today, how do I do that is I try to understand where they're coming from. It's not where they're coming from, it's how they got there. It doesn't matter where they're coming from. It's how did you get here? You know, what is the backstory? Because we all have that backstory. We just didn't show up in this condition unless we are truly a psychopath from the beginning. You know, a social psychopath or homicidal psychopath or any of those labels, you know, some of them actually show up that way. But most of us were created by our environment and the circumstances we grew up in.
So if you were to list a few things that you've learned in this journey, what would a few of those things be before we wrap up our talk?
Not everybody's out to get me. You know that, yeah. Even though if I am paranoid, the paranoids are sometimes right. You know, there is somebody out to get them. Most of the time, most of the people I have met are doing the best they are capable of doing. Which allows me to consider the possibility of being more gentle with them. You know, the old tired and true, become a better listener, you know, be present to the people I'm with. And all this is overlaid on the idea that inside of me, still someplace, is a raging lunatic. Even though I have spent 25 years, I've been sober 39 years, 25 of that I've been in therapy of one form or another, I know that anger and rage is still there. It's more manageable. I don't have to react to it, but I know it's there. Majority of the time, it's probably well contained, but occasionally it's not. And I recognize the signs now, what that means, and that I can move. I gotta go. I just have to leave. So I either get in my truck or on my bike and go someplace. It might be a week before I come back. Because I don't like it. I think we learn how to live with it. But I think it's too much to actually believe that it actually goes away. And I think it's personally a disservice to tell people that it does go away. If you work hard enough, because that sets up that failure and shame thing again. That if you work really hard and you're still angry, then it must be my fault. I didn't do it good enough. See, and I can't go there. I can't do that. Because I've already been there. I can't say I've tried my best and I'm still angry, so I'm still a shit.
Right.
Doesn't work. Because that's just going to start that thing right back up again. And so, it doesn't work.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think this story will inspire quite a few people, and I can't wait for people to hear it.
I'm so fired up about my fourth book that came out. It's called Build Your Foundation, 68 Building Blocks for a Successful and Rewarding Life. I've compressed about 25 years of knowledge, experience, and learning from a lot of people to help you in your life. You can get a copy of it over at TremendousLifeBooks.com. Again, TremendousLifeBooks.com. Here's some more information about it. For the last 25 years, I've visited with thousands of people in their homes. Many of these people I've met with have no goals, no dreams, no ambitions, and no roadmap for their life. I've seen so many people sitting on their front porches watching life go by. In 2006, my wife and I started building our home with bedrooms for each of our six kids. I always made sure that the foundation of our home was solid. I didn't want to take any chances with the lives of my family. So it is with life. My book, Build Your Foundation, 68 Building Blocks of a Successful, Rewarding Life, is jammed full of ideas that can help you today. My book is a collection of ideas and short stories really designed to help you turn your life around and to help impact the people that you care about and that you love so much. Whether you're just beginning to lay your foundation or you've already built your life but need to shore up some weak spots, Build Your Foundation will help you fortify yourself for a lifetime of success and to give you the courage to go for your dreams in life. Don't miss out on what you can accomplish. You can scale any height and achieve any goal. This book will help you get there. I have a passion to help millions of people change their lives. This book is easy to read, has short chapters, and can help you right now and change your life today. I believe in you. Thank you so much for listening to the John Carver Show. If you want more information about me, just simply go to my website, www.johnwcarver.com. Again, thanks so much for listening to the show today, and remember, I believe in you.
Thank you for listening to the John Carver Show. Please tune in again right here Monday through Friday for more insights and opinions on how you can reach your goals and dreams in life.